midway last week, but we're going to continue on where we left off. But before we do so, I just want to rehash a little bit here where we are and what we're currently looking at in 2 Samuel chapter 2. Now, you'll remember last week I mentioned, and we read through the narrative here. We saw how David was, well, that was a few Sundays ago, but we saw how David was accepted by the men of Judah, seeing him as their righteous king, and honestly seeing him as the rightful heir of the throne because of the fact, and this is what I mentioned last week, the fact that that anointing as king, there's no way one could deny that. There's no way one could discount that. And there were repetitious anointings of David as the rightful king of Israel. But as I also said, this didn't come without its struggles. You know, this did not come without opposition. And for this reason, as the Lord Jesus was a man of sorrows, in many ways, David was a man of sorrows. And this little intro to the book that I gave Rebecca, that applied to Christ, but in many ways, that applies to us as well. Just this last week, I continued on that theme with our men on Thursday night as we looked at Romans chapter 8 and Paul's theme there of suffering equaling glory. In other words, there is no entrance through the gates of glory without a bit of suffering. And that is just part and parcel. That is germane with the Christian walk. But what is amazing is the fact that, and this is where Paul comes in verses 28 and further, where he says that all things, even our sufferings, God has intended for our good. Doesn't matter what it is. And sometimes we lose track of that. Sometimes we lose sight of that. We look at our circumstances and we stare ourselves blind in the here and now, and we forget that each and everything, those things that we like, those things that are palatable, if I can put it that way, those things that are even really nice, because there's many things that we can enjoy in this Christian life, isn't it? Even in this world as such, there's many things we can enjoy. But I want to say even those things that are not so nice, when sickness comes and knocks on the door, or death, or we lose our job, or whatever it might be, even all of these things God intended for our good, which is, it's a bit of a crazy thought in and of itself. But that's why Christianity is not for the faint of heart. It really isn't. And I will not do my job as a pastor if I sketch this picture of Christianity that is all just moonshine and roses. And sadly, some do that. And I'm not sure how they get to that point, because from cover to cover, there's a lot of suffering in the Bible. There's a lot. And of all, it was God's children who in a very particular way went through various tests, trials, and tribulations. And the Lord deemed it necessary for them. Why? Because apparently it's for their good. It's for their good. So here in this context of 2 Samuel 2, the same would apply to David here. The very same would apply to David. You know, and I said, you would almost think, look, I mean, just go and seize the throne already. Just go and get over there. Take your mighty men. And they were mighty men. They probably could have done it. They were trained infantrymen. And in this battle that we're going to look at today, it was hands down a victory for David's men yet again. So a part of us should want to say, David, just go and seize the throne, get going, sit on the throne, and start to enforce your rule over Israel. But the Lord did not want that for him right yet. Because apparently the Lord wanted a little bit more suffering for him. And as I've said before, the suffering for David never ended. It never did. It was more intense at certain times than at others. Even sometimes it was not as bad, I suppose, and life was a little bit more palatable. But as a general rule, it never ended for him, because that's a golden rule. It never ends for a child of God. It certainly never does. Let's pick up our reading from verse 8 on, just to gain some context, and then we'll dive right into it. Now Abner, the son of Ner, without a D, okay, commander of Saul's army, had taken Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul, and brought him over to Mahanaim. And he made him king over Gilead, over the Asherites, over Jezreel, over Ephraim, and over Benjamin, even over all Israel. Ish-bosheth, Saul's son, was 40 years old when he became king over Israel, and he was king for 2 years. The house of Judah, however, followed David. And the time that David was king in Hebron over the house of Judah was 7 years and 6 months. Now things are going to start to intensify. Now Abner, the son of Ner, went out from Mahanaim to Gibeon with the servants of Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul. And Joab, the son of Zeruiah, and the servants of David went out and met them by the pool of Gibeon. And they sat down, one on the one side of the pool and the other on the other side of the pool. Then Abner said to Joab, "Now let the young men arise and hold a contest before us." And Joab said, "Let them arise." So they arose and went over by count, 12 for Benjamin and Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul, and 12 of the servants of David. And each one of them seized his opponent by the head and thrust his sword in his opponent's side. So it's already gory, right? What's happening here? It's already death that's surfacing here. So they fell down together. Therefore, that place was called Helkath Hazurim, which is in Gibeon. And that day, the battle was very severe, and Abner and the men of Israel were defeated before the servants of David. Now the three sons of Zeruiah were there, Joab and Abishai and Azael. And Azael was as swift-footed as one of the gazelles which is in the field. And Azael pursued Abner and did not turn to the right or to the left from following Abner. Then Abner turned to look behind him and said, "Is that you, Azael?" And he answered, "It is I." Probably huffing and puffing, right, as he's doing that. So Abner said to him, "Turn to your right or to your left and seize one of the young men for yourself and take for yourself his spoil." But Azael was not willing to turn aside from following him. And Abner repeated again to Azael, "Turn aside from following me. Why should I strike you to the ground? How then could I lift up my face, to your brother Joab?" However, he refused to turn aside. Therefore, Abner struck him in the belly with the butt end of the spear, so that the spear came out at his back. And he fell there and died on the spot. And it happened that all who came to the place where Azael had fallen and died stood still. I'm going to read up to there, and then we're going to draw some observations from this text that we just read. Now, what we have here is a challenge to war, really. But many commentators, they don't see this exactly the same way. Some would say what we have here is just all out challenging someone to war. This is now Abner challenging David's men to war. And it certainly would seem to be the case, because that is certainly something that seems to be endemic to Abner's choice of language. Just read there with me verse 14 again. "Then Abner said to Joab, 'Now let the young men arise and hold a contest before us.' And Joab said, 'Let them arise,'" as if to take this challenge, right? To accept this challenge of, "Look, this is now war. All right, let's just go out and gloves off, and we're going to just go at each other, and we're going to try and see who is the winner." And this is because of Abner's provocation. Okay? Abner is the one who is provoking the battle here, not so much David. Again, David didn't want this conflict. He didn't want, even with Saul, remember his example that he set throughout 1 Samuel and here into 2 Samuel. He was more for peace between the two groups. He just wanted God's will. And yes, David also had his sins. That is certainly true. But at least we see this as his example. When Saul was still alive, he never, ever lifted his hand to Saul. There was that one time, remember, when he cut off the little part of his tunic. And he felt so bad about that. All right, because that was not a kind thing to do. But that was the height of it. That was the height of it. David, as a repeated theme, he didn't want fights. He didn't want fighting. He didn't want dissension. He didn't want any of this. He just wanted God's will in many ways. But Abner on the other hand, he wants a fight here now. This is what he is aiming for here. Hence his challenge. Let's pick 12 men on either side, and let's see if we can determine a winner here, and we get this done and dusted. We just get this over and done with. Now let me just say something here at this point. It would be obvious that Abner knew who he was up against. He was not unfamiliar with what David and his men was capable of. He knew that they would slay thousands of Philistines and then come back and have a braai. He knew that. He knew what they were capable of. He knew that God was on their side in some ways or another. But yet, maybe for some minute reason, he thought that he had a righteous reason to do what he's doing. But he didn't know that all this time, all the while, God's will was going to prevail. God's will was going to succeed as David eventually assumes the role of the king of Israel. Now let me say something about this battle. They came together at this body of water, Gibeon, we're told. And what we know about Gibeon is that it was a watering hole for animals. It's something that formed throughout the centuries, perhaps through an underwater spring that nourished it. And so throughout the centuries, it was actually carved out by the water, and they eventually got to the point where they bricked it out with stone and mortar. And this was a permanent place of watering animals, making sure your animals are fine. Remember, this is the Middle East. Water is not plentiful as in other countries. And so so there was a real prizing. There was a real sense in which bodies of water were cherished and taken care of and protected. Now here these men are. They're gathering then not to water their animals. That's not why they're doing that. They're gathering there to have a face-off. So now, like for David on his side, perhaps to say, look, lay down your arms, because this is God's will that I eventually become the king of Israel. But Abner, on the other hand, you'll remember, he went behind everybody's back and he anointed Ishbosheth as the king of Israel. That's what he did, thinking that that's the right course of action. Here we have these two groups now having this face of squaring each other off. And as we just read, it ends in bloodshed. It ends in bloodshed. And this is what is truly sad about this. This is brother against brother. Not necessarily biological brother against brother. That's not what I'm talking about. But this is, it might as well be South Africans fighting against South Africans. This is a miniature civil war that we have here. This is Jewish brother and one who is supposed to follow Yahweh and obey Yahweh in every way, now waging war against another Jewish brother who is also under the same Yahweh. This is what makes this so terrible. This is what makes this so horrible. In some way, Israel's clashes with the Philistines, that was understood, right? This is now those who follow Yahweh against the pagan heathen, right? That makes sense. Those kinds of conflicts would make sense. Even the Amalekites, they didn't have the true God. We can understand conflict erupting between those two groups. Maybe to transport it a little bit forward for us so we can understand, even the Crusades of the Middle Ages, I think there was a purpose. There was a good purpose for that. There was an obvious enemy. But here, this is not the situation. This was a very tense situation, and this was literally the propagating of civil unrest among these brothers. And this was not God's will. This is not what God wanted for them. Rather, what God wanted was obedience, and to admit who was the true rightful king of Israel. So verses 13 to 17 is really, this is one of those very dark passages from Israelite history. It really is. This is sad. We should be sad when we read something like this. But I know this is God's will. This is what God allowed. This is how it was going to happen for David. There was going to be these things happening before he could be the rightful king of Israel. But it's truly lamentable. It's so sad that brother could lift sword against brother. Now, how do we understand this Hebrew word that Abner used as he now challenges these men to a conflict? And he uses the word contest, a contest, or to hold a contest. Read there with me again in verse 14. Now let the young men arise and hold a contest before us. What exactly is in mind with this word contest? As I've said, theologians disagree on this. Commentators, they don't exactly see eye to eye on how to understand this. And there's three plausible ways that I'd like to say in which one can understand this. Okay. The first of which is what I've already said. This is a challenge to full-on war. And maybe to them it made sense to choose their foremost battlemen or warriors and let that be what sets the trend for this little battle or war between them. That's one plausible explanation. But another would be that this was actually a battle that was representative of who would be the winner. Now, you will remember when David was still a young man, he was still a shepherd boy, they dressed him up in a full-on suit of armor and he went and he faced Goliath. Do you remember that? And that was something that could constitute as a representative battle. In other words, that was not uncommon or abnormal for the ancients to do that. They would pick their choicest warrior, and then they would have this warrior, you know, engage in a duel with the enemy's choicest warrior. And we know what happened there, right? The rest was history. David overcame Goliath, and then, to say the least, the Israelites overcame the Israelites that day. That's another plausible explanation, I think, that is in mind with this word contest here. But then again, some commentators would say, no, this is actually just a challenge to a game of sport. Okay? That very, very quickly erupted into something else. And I suppose one can even understand that as well, because you know, here you have two groups who, maybe not so much David, but remember there was Joab and there was all the other mighty men who on many occasions told David, look, now's your time. Now's your time to take your enemies in your hands and to overcome them. They couldn't wait to end this conflict. They couldn't wait. Not so much David, but maybe his mighty men. And if it is that it was a challenge to call it a military game that perhaps could in some way reveal who's the most talented and who's the most skilled army, because armies would do that too, perhaps because of this intense anticipation of a victory, and perhaps even because of some hatred going back and forth, this game quite quickly erupted into a real game, not a game, but into a real battle, which is full-out war. How can I illustrate this to you? Well, imagine the Ukraine and Russia having a friendly game of soccer now. Okay? I think there is still a conflict going on there, right? Help me out if I'm wrong. All right, maybe it won't end well. All right, so I'm kidding here. I'm just trying to explain to you more or less what is in mind here. All right? If this was just a friendly sort of challenge, if this is what Abner intended through this contest, let's have a contest and see who's the best. Let's see who's the better man. One can understand how it would quickly erupt into something bloody. But I think perhaps the best explanation is that this was just as it was for David when he faced Goliath. It makes the most sense to see this as a representative battle. Abner saying, come, you best men, you're going to now face David's best men. And it is indeed going to be a fight to the death. But I think we've got to be careful to be too dogmatic on this. We just don't know, because it's very difficult to understand this Hebrew word for contest. But here's what we do know. We know that it went horribly bad after this, isn't it? Verse 15 onwards. So they arose and went over by count. There's now 12 men on each side. They went over by count, 12 for Benjamin and Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, and 12 of the servants of David. And each one of them seized his opponent by the head. Okay, you don't quite do that, I would say, from off the bat in a friendly game, even if it's a military game. Maybe there are some sports that look like that, but still it's not to the death. Because what we read here is that grabbing by the head quickly led to thrusting of the sword. And so they fell together. Therefore that place was called Helkath Hazurim, which is in Gibeon. And then this is what happens. That day the battle was very severe, and Abner and the men of Israel were defeated before the servants of David. There in verse 16, where it says that they all fell together, it can create the impression that this is now all 24 of them who basically died on the spot. Like it's like there's no more warriors left, in a sense. But verse 17 tells us that that's not what happened. This seemed to have been a clear hands-on victory for David and his men, which would have at this point, or which should have at this point, for Abner been yet another indication, don't mess with David. Don't mess with David and his mighty men. Why? Because God is on their side. And God's will is going to prevail. So now this can turn into a bloody conflict, a stretched out conflict, but in the end, God is going to have his way. God is going to have his way. Without a shadow of doubt. But Abner doesn't choose to put down the sword. He doesn't. This erupts into a full-on, full-scale battle, which we're going to look at momentarily. But I want to reiterate this. What is truly sad about this is that it is brother against brother. This is kinsman against kinsman. This is Jewish tribe against Jewish tribe, if you will. And there are some sad reminders of brother fighting against brother in world history. One such sad reminder is the American Civil War. I don't know if you know much about the American Civil War. But it was literally like that, as they were divided by the Mason-Dixon line, separating the northern states from the Confederate states. It was brother lifting arms against brother. It was so sad. There's a recounting of this in the lives of the two Campbell brothers, Alexander and James Campbell, both of whom were born in Scotland, went to America, ended up on opposite sides of the Mason-Dixon divide, and they ended up shooting at each other. How sad is that? And that happened a lot in the American Civil War. And this is some of what we have going on here. But what makes this even more sad, if I can put it that way, is that this is now people who should know God's will. They should know what God has ordained, what God has decreed, in a sense. And yet this fight rages on. And I'm not saying that so much about David, because David wanted to remain passive in this. But look, you can't just stand back, right? You got to defend in some way or another. And that's what David was doing. Because in defending, he was also defending Israel, really. He was defending Israel. But Abner kept going at it. He kept going at it. And he wouldn't relent. This altercation between, call it the company of Saul, represented by Abner and Ishbosheth, versus David, became a classic case of brother against brother. Flesh and blood against flesh and blood, of the same clans, of the same part of the world, same laws, same everything, same senses of humor, perhaps. Same mannerisms, similar personalities in some way, similar customs in some way or another. And yet, here they are fighting one another because one party does not understand the will of God as the other does. Now, how do we make sense of this in today's age? Speaking of the church, well, in my short career, I've had a fair share of church conflict. I have. It's like each of them has a gray hair here. Okay, some of them 20 or 30 gray hairs. And it can get ugly. It can get horrible in churches sometimes. I've been, and I'm talking here about back row Baptist churches, okay? I've been in meetings where people get up and slander each other in the congregation of the meeting place, in the congregation of the church. And this is not right. And look, and I'm not trying to detract from what is important and what isn't. Look, if there's a important reason for conflict arising, of course, we understand that. But we do so righteously, right? We don't fight fire with fire as Christians. And even if we do have disagreements, and I pray by God's grace that we won't have to worry about intense disagreements or conflicts in this church. But as is the process for any church, the day's going to come. And we've had some times here. We've had some times. But it wasn't anything like this. It wasn't like brother against brother. But there are sometimes examples that can be extracted in church history where it was literally brother against brother in the same church. And in the heat of battle, they forget the Christian virtues. Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, all nine of them. Because sometimes Christians can be so zealous for what they believe and for what is right, or whatever it is they think is right, that then all of a sudden becomes more important than not losing a brother because I'm unkind to that brother, or I'm unloving to that brother or sister. And I want to say here this morning, it's not worth it, dear listener. It simply isn't. God, who is a God of truth, is also a God of love, is He not? Yes, Christians have to major in truth. Of course we do. Of course we do. That is the essence of who we are, in a sense. But everything bathed in kindness, bathed in tenderness, bathed in love, right? Think Christ's example. Think how He was reviled and He was not reviled back. Or rather, He did not revile back. He didn't return insult for insult. I mean, He was factual, to be sure. He never bent the truth. He never hid the truth in some way or another. He never did that. But He never sinned in the process. He continued being a wonderful representation of God on earth. Even when the wheels started coming off, Jesus continued modeling this example. Paul says it so well in Philippians chapter 2. Go there with me. This is a passage that I've preached maybe 3-4 times already, I think. It's just one of my favorite passages in Scripture. Philippians chapter 2. He says, therefore, verse 1, if there is any encouragement in Christ, if there is any consolation of love, if there is any fellowship of the Spirit, if any affection and compassion, fulfill my joy that you think the same way, as if to say, may your way be the way of Christ. And may it be His example that you model in everything. Whether there's, even if there's heresy. Now, heresy is something that we should be quick to be able to denounce, right? Sometimes it can get difficult when topics in Scripture are a little bit more on the peripheral than those things that are at the core of Christianity. But let's say even in the midst of heresy, we have to model the way of Christ. And he says, although verse 6, existing in the form of God, did not regard equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself, by taking on the form of a slave, by being made in the likeness of men, being found in appearance as a man. This is what he did. He humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death. That's talking about the death of the cross. Therefore, God also highly exalted him and bestowed on him the name which is above every name, so that at the name of Jesus, every knee will bow of those who are in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and that every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father. So then, my beloved, just as you have always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence, work out your salvation with fear and trembling, as if to say, aha, this is the example that you have to follow. This is the example that has been set for us, and this should be our way of thinking. And that's how we work out our salvation with fear and trembling. That's how we do it. And I want to say there can be real fear and trembling if there is a lapse in modeling this behavior. But we can't get around verse 5. Have this way of thinking. Let this be your mind. Maybe some translations here this morning would say that. Let this be your mind, which is also in Christ Jesus, who humbled himself even in the midst of the most trying circumstances. And perhaps this was David's example. Go back to 2 Samuel. We don't have record of that, but Joab was the one who was quick to the chase, wasn't he? After Adam was like, come on, let's have a fight. And Joab was like, all right, let's do it. No, okay. Let's see this in context. These were the generals of these two armies. But even in silence, I want to say, because of David's example, the example that he set throughout 1 and 2 Samuel of being benevolent, of being peaceful, of not wanting to take up arms, I guess it is safe to say that the same attitude is present here in David. He didn't want this. He didn't want this. But yet Abner so desperately wanted it. He wanted it. As the battle concluded in death, it was clearly David's men who prevailed. Verse 17 tells us that much. And now things erupt even further. Read there with me verse 18 on. Now these three sons of Zeruiah were there, Joab and Abishai and Azael. And Azael was as swift-footed as one of the gazelles which is in the field. Now this is what we know about Azael. Apparently, there was mention made of him by Josephus. Josephus was a Jewish historian. And apparently, the rumor was that Azael was so fast that he could even outrun a horse. That's amazing. I'm not so sure about that. It might be like a obese, three-legged, pregnant horse. I don't know that they have in mind here. Because a horse is fast, okay? Like any quadruped. I think they say even a rat can run faster than the fastest Olympic sprinters, over 100 meters. Okay, four legs makes all the difference, that's why. So it must have been a severely handicapped horse that they were talking about here. But that does not detract from the way that we understand here what's going on. Azael could run. I mean, just say like we can understand it. Hij was haastig. All right, he was no slouch. And this man could... he could run, and now what we have here is because he has pace, he goes for the kingpin. That's who he goes for. You know what I mean by that, right? He's going for the main peanut in the packet. He's going after Abner, because if he can get Abner, then it's going to be complete disarray for Abner and his men. If you strike the captain, you strike the general, then the troops start to scatter, and this is what Azael is doing. But then this happens, and this is quite interesting. I love this. Verse 19, and Azael pursued Abner and did not turn to the right or to the left from following Abner, as if to say he was dead set on killing Abner that day. That's what he wanted to do. Perhaps this was the fastest that he ever ran, pursuing Abner. And then this happens, verse 20. Then Abner turned to look behind him and said, is that you, Azael? Maybe he saw it, like as he glanced back. And just in a quick glimpse, he could figure out that it was Azael. And maybe it came with a little bit of knowledge as well, because he might have known Azael was very quick and that he would be the one to pursue him. And so he asked, is that you, Azael? And he answered, yes, it is I. So Abner said to him, turn to your right or to your left and seize one of the young men for yourself, and take for yourself his spoil. Now this is what we have here. Interestingly, even in the heat of battle, What we see Abner now doing is he's being gracious. This is quite interesting, I must say. And it is certainly something that deserves observance here this morning. This is definitely an observation to make. Look, after it's now guns blazing. They didn't have guns, of course. There's just now swords being flung in all kinds of directions, spears being hurled, maybe archers who are launching arrows at each other. There's just full out war and mayhem. Even in the midst of, I want to say, circumstances where you would think no rules are applying anymore and that it's just law of the jungle, we see Abner being merciful. And he's telling Azael, Azael, and by the way, this comes with knowledge and this comes with experience. So young men, be careful before you take on an experienced older man. Okay? Apparently Azael needed to hear this. Maybe Azael had an inflated understanding of his capabilities as a warrior. Yes, he could run. He could run. But could he combat? And apparently no, as the story unfolds. But Abner knew that. Abner knew that much about Azael. And he said to him, he said, look, what is it worth me shedding your blood here this day? Turn to your right, verse 21, or to your left, and seize one of the young men for yourself. As it to say, go and find someone that is your equal. And even take for yourself his spoil. But Azael, we read, was not willing to turn aside from following him. And Abner was even gracious enough and merciful enough to repeat this. Verse 22. Again, he said to Azael, turn aside from following me. Why should I strike you to the ground? As to say, what's the use of this? What is the use of it? Why should I do this? And here's the real reason. How then could I lift up my face to your brother Joab? How can I do it? How can I face him ever again? Again, I want to reiterate this. This is brother against brother. This is kinsman against kinsman. This is people who have the same culture, the same religion, the same everything. How can I kill you and ever again face your brother? How can I do it? That's one reason why Abner said it. But perhaps some other things that were going on in his heart involved the fact that, well, Joab is a mighty general. And from that moment on, perhaps he would be a marked man. And that Joab and his men would not relent from avenging his brother's blood. And perhaps that was also in his heart. At least that's how this history unfolds anyways. Because Joab does not relent. And he continues on until the bitter end. And sadly, that's often how war works, is until the bitter end. And let's draw these verses apart a bit. Verse 18, who is this Zeruiah that we are reading about here? Zeruiah was a woman who was the sister of David. She was a sister of David. And so all three of these men were sons of Zeruiah, the fastest of them, Azael. And this is now the one who has died here on the battlefield, as these verses tell us. Verse 23, however, he refused to turn aside. Therefore, Abner struck him in the belly with the butt end of the spear, so that the spear came out his back, and he fell there and died on the spot. And it happened that all who came to the place where Azael had fallen and died stood still. Very sad. But I don't want to be too hasty here. I want to go back to this behavior that's being modeled here by Abner in this instance. As I've said, he's showing mercy to Azael. And yes, maybe it was intertwined with a little bit of fear for what could come. But I think this is a prime example of mercy even when there is no law, when it is just arrows flying in all directions. And over he warns him and he tells him, don't. And he's being obviously merciful to him, even in a circumstance where perhaps many Jews at that point in time forgot the laws of Yahweh. All right? Like being kind to your neighbor, loving your neighbor. That's, by the way, that's the golden rule of the Old Testament, to love the Lord your God with your whole heart, soul, and strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself. Right? These were neighbors fighting each other. And perhaps that's some of what Abner was thinking here. Well, this made me think about just like in modern times, you know, how do we understand this in modern terms? And I want to say, even for Christians, sometimes war is unavoidable. It is undeniable that war is sometimes unavoidable. However, a Christian never stops being a Christian just because they are at war. You never stop being a child of God. Even if there was a real threat right now and we all had to go to war, all the men, we don't stop being Christians. We don't stop being ambassadors of Christ. And it's sad though that certain environments have earned themselves the reputation of being vile because there's a lot of men present. It's so sad that that's the case, isn't it? And that's very much true of the army. You know, you'll ask some of the previous generations and they'll tell you that's where they learn how to swear. That's where they learn how to smoke. That's where they learn how to, you know, get hold of dirty magazines. Often these things happen in the army. All right. It's very sad when that happens. Because we don't stop being Christians when we are preparing for war or even going to war. I want to say the same about sport these days. Why is it so sad that, and it's true, that certain team sports, often it becomes the breeding ground for all things smutty and dubious and debauched. Why is that the case? Why is that the case? But especially when you put a bunch of guys together, it can get like that. Now I know we're dealing here oftentimes with people who are unsaved and all these things, but sadly even Christians succumb to this. They succumb to this. And that's something we keep in mind as we now like raise our children and we just, you know, trying to decide maybe what sport they'll play, what they'll be involved in, because we know some of these things have certain things embedded in them which we're going to have to circumnavigate along the way. Because it might be in a locker room somewhere that my boy gets exposed to pornographic images. It's not impossible. It's not impossible. There can be a group mentality that forms that it's just not right for Christians to follow along with and to go with. And I think Abner understood something about this. I think he did. Now, we don't know if he was truly saved or not. The Bible doesn't tell us. But I think it can be assumed he had some reverence for Yahweh. At that point in time, he was totally, totally convinced that he was doing the right thing. But we'll see in a few verses, the next chapter on, we'll see how he eventually joins David's cause. Now, here's how it all ended. And then I'm going to be done. Read there with me from verse 24. But Joab and Abishai pursued Abner. This is now after the death of Azael. But Joab and Abishai pursued Abner. Now the sun was going down, and they came to the hill of Ammah, which is in front of Giah, by the way of the wilderness of Gibeon. And the sons of Benjamin gathered together behind Abner and became one band. And they stood on the top of a certain hill. Then Abner called to Joab and said, "Shall the sword devour forever?" Now, in one sense, look, you were the guy who provoked this, weren't you? You're the guy who started provoking. But maybe there was some relent along the way. And now, especially after Azael has been slain, now there's more hatred. And yet he feels like saying, let's stop this. Do you not know that it will be bitter in the end? How long will you refrain from telling the people to turn back from following their brothers? And now it's Joab who's answering, and you can just imagine the vengeance that's already in his heart. He just can't wait to get his hands on Abner. And he said, verse 27, "As God lives, if you had not spoken, surely then the people would have only gone away in the morning, each from following his brother." As if to say, if you had not provoked this battle to begin with, So Joab blew the trumpet, and all the people stood still and pursued Israel no longer, nor did they continue to fight anymore. But Abner and his men then went through the Arabah all the night. So they crossed the Jordan, walked all morning, and came to Mahanaim. Now Joab returned from following Abner. And he had gathered all the people together, and 19 of David's servants besides Azael were missing. But the servants of David had struck down many of Benjamin and Abner's men, so that 360 men died. And they took up Azael and buried him in his father's tomb, which was in Bethlehem. Then Joab and his men went all night until the day dawned at Hebron. And this last phrase here, I'm done. This last phrase here is what indicates to us that vengeance has not dissipated, and it won't for Abner. Because of what Abner did, and the fact that he killed Azael, Joab is not going to rest until that wrong is made right. But we will continue this on next week. Hopefully I'm going to be in better shape. We hope to see you all again next Sunday as we continue things on in 2 Samuel. And I'm going to be starting chapter 3 then next week for just so we can get through this. How many passages do we have here? How many chapters? Hang on. I don't even know. I mean, it's a big book. And 24 in all. So we really got to pick up the pace a little. Join us for that next Sunday. I bid you a good Sunday. The Lord be with you. Enjoy what you have planned, whether it be some nice lunch with friends and family or whatever it is, maybe just to have a nice restful afternoon. Thank you for joining us, and we hope to see you all again next Sunday. The Lord be with you. Thank you.